We're time for Pentateuch class. So we're going to pick up with chapter 37 of Genesis, and it's the beginning of a new story. I'll just make a point of what it says in verse 2. This is the history of Jacob. That's that word that we introduced way back at the beginning, toldoth, which I think history is a good translation, especially here. It's indicating this is the start of a new story, perhaps of a new historical document. And I'd like to make the point that it's funny because it says this is the history of Jacob, and then it tells all about Joseph, which I've sometimes laughed when I read that. But I think it's a matter of it's going to tell how Jacob's descendants ended up in Egypt. And that's one of the main points of this story. But of course, there's so much more. And I'm working up to the point I wanted to make. This is one of the great dramatic stories in all of human literature. I mean, it ranks up there with War and Peace, and I've never read War and Peace, but I've heard enough about it. It's supposed to be really good. And whatever other great story you've heard, this is one of them. It has great characters, great plot twists, irony, you know, a great tension and then resolution. And I'm not a literature professor, so I might not even be using all the terms properly, but it is one of those. Matter of fact, there's quite a few good stories in the Bible, but two of them stand out as being greats in history. One is the story of Esther, and the other one is here with the story of Joseph. And of course, if you have your personal favorite, you might like one or another, you know, other stories just as well. But I'm passing on, you know, well, I don't disagree with those and those evaluations and statements, but I didn't originate them. I'm passing on what I've got from other scholars. So as we dive in, of course, as it says, beginning of chapter 37, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. So we've built up to that. Remember, before we went away to the feast, we followed the story of Jacob, where he went off, he was sent away to away from his family because his brother Esau wanted to kill him for, you know, cheating him out of his birthright. He went and, wanted to marry Rachel, but ended up getting Leah and a couple of concubines, you know, in for good measure. He was cheated and deceived by his uncle Laban in the same way he had cheated and deceived others. And not that I want to rehash all of Jacob's story, but one of the things we've seen is that Jacob matured a great deal spiritually. You know, he's one of the people we get to see from the time he was very young until he's very old. And we see he's a very different person later in life than he was when he was younger. It reminds me, that's a lesson that I've tried to point out with summer camp counselors when I've got to work with them, is that people change. And we don't want to fix our view of someone based on an earlier experience, when knowing especially when we're in our teens and 20s, we can change and develop quite a bit. That's sort of a side issue, but here we see a vivid example of someone who changes and develops and grows. Keep that in mind, because I'm going to point out one of his sons. We seem to have not as much evidence, but quite a bit. And I'll just mention it'll be Judah. Judah seems to change and grow quite a bit in the course of this story. Anyways, we're moving on. Of course, I mentioned in verse 2, this is the history of Jacob. Then it says, Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. The lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Of course, Jacob had four wives. Two were considered real wives. I'm not sure if I say real wives, but primary wives. And Zilpah and Bilhah were concubines. It says Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. I've seen some accounts say, well, it seems that perhaps Joseph is in charge of the flocks, and so he's reporting back to his dad. If that's the case, that's a lot of responsibility to put on a pretty young guy. You know, he might have been very competent at a young age, but one thing we obviously see very soon is that Jacob showed favoritism. And every story about this indicates, of course, that Jacob liked Joseph the best, and he didn't hide it. And that's setting up for problems. And you'd think, considering, remembering when he was young, Jacob was the favorite of Rebekah, where Esau was the favorite of Isaac, and the favoritism caused a lot of trouble. Jacob should have learned that lesson, but it took him a while. Anyways, of course, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, in case you're wondering, were Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, all of whom were older than Joseph. Yeah, so, well, another thing I was going to point out, what we see just in these two verses makes Joseph seem like quite a tattletale. And nobody likes a tattletale if you're the one being tattled on. That's a phrase people use still today, right? I've used it with my son. Don't be a tattletale. But if you're Jacob and you want to hear if these guys are goofing around and not doing a good job, you could say Joseph was being a conscientious employee reporting in. Two ways to interpret it. Anyways, moving on, of course, it says very clearly in verse 3, Israel, notice he's going by that name rather than just Jacob, he loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Probably not only that he was the son of his old age, but the son of his favorite wife. He showed favoritism in that way. And he made him a tunic of many colors. The famous, Technicolor dream coat. Any of you guys seen the musical? I've heard the music. I've never seen the musical. Any of you seen the Ballad of Little Joe, the VeggieTales version? No, I kind of like that one. It's a Western. I thought about bringing it in and showing part of it. I might break down and relent and do that. One of the things I like most about it, of course, is Joseph's birthday, and since they're out west, he gives him a vest of many colors, and he's modeling. He says, "This vest says I'm special." And the other brothers are saying, "What did we get for our birthdays? Mittens." What do mittens say? They say that you're not as special as your brother. That's what they say. The favoritism came through quite a bit, and they didn't like it. Verse 4, when the brothers saw their father loved him more, all his brothers hated him. They couldn't speak peaceably. Could mean, most likely this means exactly what it says. They just didn't get along. They were critical. I've seen some accounts say this is a literal interpretation because the Hebrew word for peace is shalom, which is also the common greeting. And I've seen some scholars suggest that it just means they refuse to use that proper etiquette. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's a matter of brothers being mean to each other. In any event, whatever it is, Jacob should have seen this coming. And it's going to get worse. Joseph had a dream, in verse 5. He told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he describes the dream, which I'll sum up. He's, we were binding sheaves in the field. Look, my sheaf arose and stood upright, which is something sheaves don't typically do. I mean, they might stand because they're bound that way. And all the others stood around and bowed down. And his brothers were angry, saying, "Are you going to reign over us?" They saw the obvious interpretation, which is the interpretation you'd put on it. These dreams did turn out to be prophetic. Of course, he has the other dream starting in verse 9. I dreamed a dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. I don't know, these must have been very vivid dreams, and we don't know how much God let Joseph know that they were prophetic. Because later we'll see that Joseph is given a gift by God to interpret dreams. And we don't have a story of when and how he learned that he could interpret dreams. But in some ways, it's also somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy because the brothers were upset about this. That's what inspired them to sell him into slavery, which I'm guessing I'm not giving away a story that you don't all know. And of course, that led through the process of time, the chain of events that would lead him to being the leader in Egypt. And of course, they would come bow down to him not knowing who he was. So again, the remarkable irony there. But it's interesting, one thing that makes us wonder a little bit about the chronology, there in verse 10, even Jacob rebuked him. He said, "What dream is this you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down before you?" One of the things that it's easy to read over is Jacob says, "Your mother." Who was Joseph's mother? Rachel. If all of Genesis is in strict chronological order, Rachel has already died in childbirth with Benjamin. What this tells us is we don't know if perhaps this section might be slightly out of order. Like all of Joseph's story might be combined together, and so some of this happened before some other things are recorded. And I say maybe, we don't know for certain. Jacob could have been referring to Leah as the mother of the family, especially if Rachel's already dead. There's two possible explanations of that. But there are a lot of scholars who say that the chronology isn't quite straight here because they wanted to keep all of Joseph's story in one place. Although that makes the next chapter a bit puzzling, but we'll worry about that when we get there. I'm taking a really interesting story and making it boring here, so you'll have to bear with me. I'm not trying to do that. Anyways, at verse 11, his brothers envied him, but his father kept it in mind. Jacob's seen enough and had enough dealings with God to think, I wonder what's going on here. Maybe there is something to this. Okay, in verse 12, the brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said, Joseph, oh, your brothers are feeding the flock in Shechem. I'm going to send you to them. So he said, go, please see if it's well with your brothers and their flocks and bring back word. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron and went to Shechem. The name Shechem should sound a little familiar, but it might not stick in your head. Shechem is the place where the incident with Dinah occurred. When, Dinah was taken and molested, raped, whatever, and Simeon and Levi go and kill all the men. So, assuming this did happen after that event, no wonder Jacob is a little concerned. I want you to go and make sure they're okay. There's none of the men left of the village of Shechem, but remember the surrounding peoples he was worried about. They're camped in the valley of Hebron, which is down here, and Shechem is way up here, which is a distance, I believe, that I read it was about 40 miles, and I'm looking to see. Yeah, actually more like 50 or 60 miles away. So Joseph, we don't know, this is probably after he was 17 years old. He's a little older, but this is quite a journey to be going on alone. Anyways, he went and he was wandering around looking to see if they're there. A man found him and said, what are you seeking? My brothers? Tell me where they're feeding the flocks. And well, verse 17, they departed. I heard him say, let's go on to Dothan. Dothan is believed to be about 8 to 10 miles further north. So he goes on up there and he's well away from the rest of the family then. And when they saw him, this is verse 18, far off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. And said, look, here comes this dreamer. The word dreamer there, I've read it, the Hebrew literally means master of dreams. So they might have been making a sarcastic remark, this master dreamer, someone, and they might have thought he made those dreams up just to get attention. But, they decide they're going to get back at him now. Dad's not around, none of the women, the whole rest of the family. Come therefore now, let us kill him and cast him into a pit, and we'll say a wild beast has devoured him. Then we'll see what'll become of his dreams. Reuben heard it, and he delivered them out of their hands, said, let's not kill him. Don't shed blood, cast him into a pit in the wilderness. Don't lay a hand on him. And then it says, sort of as a parenthetical statement, that he might deliver them out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So Reuben is the oldest. He seems to be a bit more responsible. He's begun to think like a father and a leader of the household, at least to some degree. He's seeing things from Jacob's perspective, so he doesn't want to kill Joseph, even though he might not like him very much. But they did in verse 23. They stripped him of his tunic of many colors, and they threw him in the pit. And it might have been a cistern or something, because it says there was no water in it. Sat down to eat. They lifted their eyes, and there's a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Remember, Gilead is the name that'll go by later, but across the Jordan River. So they've been traveling across here, going to go past Shechem. They're on their way to Egypt, and they're merchants. They're carrying spices, balm, myrrh. Judah gets this great idea. Well, there's no profit just killing our brother and hiding his blood. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be on him. He's our brother, And so they listened to him and agreed to it. And you'll notice in verse 28, it says, Midianite traders passed by, and the brothers pulled Joseph up out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. It's not a major controversy because it's not something that matters a lot, but sometimes the question comes up, okay, did they sell him to Ishmaelites or Midianites? And possible explanations are that it was a mixed group. Remember, the Ishmaelites and Midianites are related. The Ishmaelites are descended from Ishmael, Abraham's first son. The Midianites are descended from one of the sons of Abraham by Keturah. So they're similar ethnology. They might have lived together. Another possible explanation is that they're sitting there eating and they see a caravan go by and say, hey, we could sell him. And then they see another caravan, sell him to the next one that comes past. you know, perhaps. So it's not necessarily a contradiction that causes a great deal of trouble, and maybe not one that is worth spending a lot of time on, but we try to iron out all the wrinkles as we go through here. Notice Judah is being kind of like Reuben in that he's suggesting sparing Joseph's life, but he's not trying to just deliver him back to his father. He says, hey, we can get out of killing him and we can get a little cash in the matter. 20 pieces of silver, and archaeologists have found evidence that that was the going price of a slave at that time, of an adult male slave. Of course, there'd be different prices for young or old, male or female. And interestingly, they say prices steadily climbed after that, which gives support to the idea that the biblical account is accurate. In other words, the archaeology, this is one little detail that seems to match. At about the time when this account is supposed to have happened, outside sources say that's what you could sell a slave for. And at other times, it wouldn't match. So we'll take that for what it's worth. Let's move on. In verse 29, Reuben returned. He must not have been there when they made the sale, and he sees Joseph's not in the pit. He tears his clothes. Now he's upset. Again, he's seeing it from his dad's perspective. So the lad's no more, and I, where shall I go? So they got to come up with a scheme to cover this up. They take his tunic, they kill a kid of the goats and dip the tunic in the blood. So when I think of this, you probably at least, well, if you ever watch TV, you've seen this. I don't know how many sitcoms have the situation where one lie forces another lie, which forces another lie, and it gets kind of ridiculous. Well, in sitcoms, it can just be funny, but in real life, if you tell a lie, often you get into another one. So here, you know, they're setting themselves up for a lifetime almost of lying. You know, okay, they sold Joseph. They don't want to go back and tell the family, hey, we sold our brother. They've still got his tunic. They rip it up, dip it in blood. And then although they don't tell an outright lie, they send it to Jacob. And Jacob, it says in verse, well, let's go back to 32. They brought it to their father, said, we found this. Do you know whether or not it's your son's tunic? Of course, they knew, but they're letting him draw his conclusions. Jacob recognized it. It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn in pieces. Again, did the brother say, oh, Joseph has been killed? You know, they didn't say anything. Just said, oh, look at this. You know, look what we found. Joseph or Jacob comes to a conclusion that they don't contradict. And Jacob goes into mourning. He tore his clothes, put on sackcloth on his waist, mourned his son many days. Sons and daughters tried to comfort him, but he refused. He said, I'll go down into the grave to my son in mourning. And his father wept for him. Again, now they're set up, seeing how badly this affects him. How easy would it be later to say, oh, Dad, I got to come clean. You know, he's not torn by wild beasts. We sold him. No, they're kind of stuck in this lie now and will be until it turns out Joseph is running the country of Egypt. One thing I'll point out about verse 35, where it says, I'll go down to my grave, that's the Hebrew Sheol, which is translated grave, but sometimes translated hell, also pit. It means a pit or a hole or a grave. But this is one of those places where we can use the Bible's terminology to argue against the false doctrine of an ever-burning hell. Because if Sheol means ever-burning hell, then Jacob is saying, I'm going down to hell, you know, in mourning. Jacob is one of the patriarchs who is said will be in God's kingdom. So nobody seriously thinks he's going to an ever-burning hell, but everybody can believe he went down to a grave awaiting his resurrection. Okay, so anyways, in verse 36, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. This word officer is the same word that is sometimes translated eunuch. Remember, that came up in covering Daniel, where you know Daniel and his friends are put under the care of a eunuch. But the word is equally valid being translated either way. So it's most likely this guy wasn't a eunuch, he's just a captain of the guard. But it does make us wonder, because historical records show that sometimes high-ranking eunuchs who were officers actually took wives and had households. I'm not sure if it was just for show or to have somebody to have company, you know, because they wouldn't have sexual relations. And the reason I'm bringing it up is if that were the case with Potiphar, it would make it more understandable why his wife ended up having such desire for Joseph. You know, if basically she's married to a guy who can't fulfill that part of the marriage. And I'm presenting that as a possibility. Most likely, and what I think is the case, is that Potiphar was a normal guy and his wife was just immoral. That's probably the better way to put it. So there's the situation. Joseph is now down there. We're going to pick up his story later, but there's a whole chapter now of what we would, you know, a side story, parenthetical to Joseph's, but one that's of great importance. So all of chapter 38 is going to turn away from Joseph's story and focus on Judah. And this is importance to the lineage of Jesus Christ, who is descended from Judah and from one, from the woman that'll be part of the story. It seems also to be important to the fulfillment of prophecy. And the reason for that, we'll see at the chapter's end. Matter of fact, maybe I should pause. Anybody have questions? So far, the story of Joseph is pretty straightforward. So despite me doing the best I can to obfuscate, hopefully you'll see through all that and still like the story. You're all right with me. Okay, so let's talk about Judah. Chapter 38, verse 1, it came to pass that at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And, of course, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her, went into her. She conceived and bore a son. He gave him his name so he has three sons, Onan, and Shelah. And he was at Kizib when she bore him. This might have taken place after Joseph is sold into slavery, just as it shows. Some scholars think that it actually took place earlier, and that Judah had done all that we're going to read in chapter 38 and returned to the family before they sold Joseph into slavery, which would make sense in certain ways. The main argument against it is that this isn't chapter 36, it's chapter 38, so we don't know why it would have been put in the Bible in this way. One reason, though, possibly, is it's juxtaposing the stories of Joseph and Judah. These two are very important because the inheritance of Jacob is divided in some ways between these two. Joseph is going to end up receiving the birthright, even though he's not the firstborn, and we'll discuss later how and why that could be done. Judah is going to inherit what's called the scepter promise, meaning the determination will be that the kings will come from Judah, and King David will be a Jew, and of course the line from him, and of course eventually Jesus Christ, who will be King of Kings forever. So the scepter, the rulership, goes through Judah. The birthright, the great riches and the power and the influence will go through Joseph. So we see both of their stories beginning sort of laid out. We don't know exactly why, but Judah seemed to separate from the clan. All the brothers and the large family seem to have been traveling and living together, still not really owning land. Remember, they're still strangers and pilgrims, but for reasons that aren't described here, Judah separated, and he married a Canaanite woman, and he had these three sons. Remember, Rebekah wouldn't have been happy about this if she's still alive. She wasn't happy about Esau marrying Hittite women. But we don't really discuss that here. But one thing we do know is the oldest gets old enough to be married. So this is quite a considerable time passes that Judah is separated. In verse 6, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. And Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal killed him. Some questions we have here. One is, what did do that was so wicked? And that we don't know. But you got to be pretty wicked for God to intervene directly and kill you. Well, I shouldn't say you, because God hasn't killed any of you that I know of yet, and hopefully won't. This Tamar, we don't know a lot about her. Was she a Canaanite like Judah's wife? It doesn't specifically say she was. Most scholars believe she was. And one of the reasons the question becomes important is because, okay, here is a non-Israelite that is of David's lineage and of Christ's lineage. Therefore, some will try to make the case that she wasn't a Canaanite. There's no evidence of that. The closest they can come is that Judah's wife, Shua, it specifically says she was a Canaanite. It doesn't specifically say that Tamar was. So it's sort of absence of evidence that some will try to make that claim. Of course, I don't think it matters. I think it does matter that God must have identified Tamar, or it seems likely, and said, I want her. You know, in some cases, he seems to have brought in certain people to be part of Jesus Christ's lineage. And I say seems to because it doesn't tell us for sure, but we know Tamar is going to be one of the first from outside. Then later we're going to have Rahab. Then we're going to have, Ruth. So there's an important one I was overlooking. And of course, Uriah the Hittite's wife, Bathsheba, all of these will be part of Christ's heritage. I'm mentioning them because it's interesting. When you read Christ's lineage, one thing that's out of the ordinary is that five women are mentioned. Usually you only have the men mentioned. But these five women, five is including Mary, and she was kind of important. So we say, well, there must be something of note about them. So Tamar is the first. Anyway, so we know that God killed him because he was so evil. Verse 8, Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife, marry her, and raise up an heir to your brother. Okay, this seems to have been a common practice. We know from what God gave to Israel as law later, and if you want to write the reference, it's Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 6. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6, God would command men in Israel to do this. If there are two brothers living near enough to know each other, one of them dies without any children, the brother that's left is to basically raise up and, you know, supposed to marry the widow, have a child by her that will be named for the brother that deceased. Why in the world would you do that? Thoughts? And the reason I'm pausing here is because it's very important to all of this story. You know, Tamar wants to have a child. What's so important that she has a child? And by the way, specifically, a male child is what's desired.
I guess to continue the bloodline.
Okay, that's one important reason. Continue the name, the bloodline. That's one thing that's mentioned, to continue the name.
She's a widow, and if she has a son, they can take care of her.
Okay, that's the other thing I was getting at. There's no Social Security office to send her a check every month, you know, survivor's benefits. Back then, most women were either provided for by their father, their husband, or their children. She's moved out of her father's house. Now her husband is gone, so the idea is she needs to have a child who can become the head of the family and provide for her for the rest of her life. And sorry, women, if that sounds demeaning, because I know in our society, women can provide for themselves and have good jobs and sometimes make a lot more money than their husbands. But the society they lived in at that time worked this particular way. So that's one of the reasons God provided for that. So they don't leave these widows just destitute and without support or help. Okay, so this is what she's commanded to do later, or what Onan is commanded to fulfill this responsibility that later God puts into Israel's law. Verse 9, Onan knew that the heir would not be his. It came to pass, he did go into his brother's wife, but it says he omitted on the ground lest he gave his heir to his brother. This thing displeased the Lord, so he killed him. We don't know what did, but we know what Onan did. This reminds me of when I was a kid. I remember reading the Bible when I was 11. And the old King James, it says he spilled it on the ground. I went to my grandfather and asked, what did he spill on the ground? He thought it was the funniest thing ever. And he was there, and my mom and my grandmother all struggling how to explain to a 9-year-old. And I'm not going to, you guys probably already know what this, so I'm not going to explain it. And they didn't explain it to me. The important thing is what Onan did, it's more than just a matter of birth control. It seems he wanted to be able to have sex with Tamar all he wanted, but not have the child. So he wasn't doing the right thing. He wasn't providing for her, but he also wasn't abstaining. And God didn't care for that, so he killed him. Okay, there's one son left. But by now, Judah's a little worried because two of his sons have been married to Tamar, and both of them are dead. It's easy to make a connection there, right? So Judah, he says, oh, Shelah's not old enough. So he says to Tamar, verse 11, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. But what he's thinking in his mind is, lest he die like his brother. I don't want him going to this woman. She kills men. Okay, so he sent Tamar back to live with her parents. From what we understand, this would have seemed probably a significant disgrace to her and to her parents, that she marries into this family. By the way, remember, Jacob and his sons are all pretty wealthy. So when Tamar's first married in the family, the parents are probably thinking, wow, what a great match. She's marrying into this wealthy family. Now they send her back, not looking so good. And it's worth remembering, she still legally is part of Judah's household. You know, she's married, she's obligated to Shelah, so he still has say over her, and he sends her back to her parents, but she's not free to just do whatever she wants. And that's what makes what happens next. In verse 12, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So Judah's wife dies, and eventually he's comforted. He gets over it. He goes up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. Shearing time was usually in the early spring. So shearing your sheep is when basically you're getting the wealth that can come from that. You shear them, you sell the wool. It was often a time of feasts and celebration. As a matter of fact, you can make a note in 2 Samuel 13, Absalom, remember he said, I've got sheep shearers, I'm going to have this party, send my brothers. So it was a common thing when you sheared your sheep to have a bit of a celebration. So the people in the area are having the celebration, and so they're going up there. And it was told, verse 13, Tamar saying, well, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So it's that special time. And she took off her widow's garments and covered. So she's been dressed as a widow, following the tenets of the culture. But she's realized, oh, yeah, it's in this verse, that she saw Shelah was grown and she wasn't given to him as wife. So she knows that basically she's got, it's her right as a widow, it's the widow's right to have the next male in the family take her on and provide a son for her for her support. She sees Sheila's not doing it. She's being withheld from him. So basically, she's going to devise a scheme to get the next eligible male in the family to give her her duty, so to speak. Who's the next male in the family? Judah himself. The reason I'm pointing this out, because what she does seems pretty gross, am I right? I mean, she's going to disguise herself as a prostitute and be there when he comes by. His wife is dead, and I'm guessing, I don't know if God played a hand in making him especially desirous at the time, but he sees her as a prostitute, says, here, you know, let me come into you. You know, what are you going to pay me? Well, I'll send you a goat later. I'm summarizing the story. And she's got a veil covering her face, so he doesn't get a good look at her to know who she is. And we can only wonder, I mean, I'm guessing women are kind of aware of their monthly cycle. Maybe she realizes this is a time when she could get pregnant. And that's what happens. They spend this one time together. She ends up pregnant. Sounds like on TV, it's always the one time and you get pregnant. And, oh, no. Anyways, this is what she had in mind, so it wasn't an oh no, but what I'm getting at is, so as creepy as it sounds, she's deceiving Judah to do something for her that was supposed to be done, only it should have been his son. He wouldn't let his son do it, so she deceived him into doing it. Not to say that deception is okay, but what she's doing is not as wicked and evil as it might seem on the surface. It's still kind of creepy, and it's okay to think of it that way. But we go from there, and of course, I find it kind of ironic because he says, you know, she says, what will you give? I'll send you a goat. Well, give me a pledge till then. What pledge will I give you? In verse 18, your signet cord and the staff that's in your hand. So something that's undeniably his special staff and his signet, a mark that he would use to mark documents. So it's important. She's got this. So if anybody, you know, well, actually what's going to happen later, she's got something to prove, and only he's going to know for sure, but he's got the things that were his, and he knows he gave it to that prostitute. And, well, keep that in mind. She conceived by him. So she arose, she laid aside her and put back on the garments of widowhood. So she wasn't practicing, she wasn't living life as a prostitute all the time. It was just this one time for Judah's sake. But 3 months later, I guess she's starting to show. Oh, actually, I forgot. I think it's kind of funny. He sends his friend, the Adullamite, to bring the goat. So So we go find that prostitute, give her the goat, and get me my signet and my cord and, you know, my staff back. He's looking around, well, where is she? Hey, guys, where's the prostitute that's normally here? They look at him like, what? There's no prostitute here. It's like, what kind of town do you think this is? I'm reading in, but I sort of see that. It's like, there is no prostitute around here. And so they probably don't like what he's implying, so he brings the goat back, and Judas says, well, let her keep the stuff because we can't find her. Then we get to verse 24. After 3 months, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Well, that's true in a sense, and she's with child by harlotry. Judah says, bring her out and let her be burned. That's a pretty strong sentence. It makes me wonder. Well, one thing we'd say, remember, she's still part of Judah's family legally. So he's exercising his right as the leader of the family to pass judgment. You know, don't go to a local county court here. He's the one that has the say. Now, because Tamar was to be married to Shelah, you could make the case that she's guilty of adultery. Even though she wasn't given to him, it's sort of like they're engaged. Which makes me wonder, because was the penalty for adultery, you know, the death penalty? It seems that it was. Or maybe you could make the case that it didn't have to be that, but Judah sees an opportunity to get rid of this woman. You know, she's killed two of my sons and she's trying to get the third. I'm going to get her out of the picture. We're not sure exactly what it was, but he says, let her be burned. Still, you can't deny the hypocrisy. You know, she's guilty of having sex with someone to whom she's not married. He says, let her be burned. Who was the person she had sex with? Well, him. He's not suggesting that he should be burned for it. So, you know, some people have made the case that, okay, the penalty for a fornication isn't as high as for adultery. But I tend to think it's more of him trying to get rid of her. Then, of course, comes the great drama. So she's going to be burned. And bring her out and let her be burned. She's brought out. She's sent to her father-in-law. So it indicates perhaps he's not right there. Perhaps he just sent word, or perhaps he's out in the crowd. But she makes this bold statement. Okay, by the man to whom these belong, I'm with child. Please determine whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. You know, this is the person that I got pregnant by. At some point, whether immediately or later, okay, Judah sees. And we'll give him credit for all the slimy things you've done. It says he acknowledged them. He'll say, those are mine. I'm the one that got her pregnant. And because, and he says, she's been more righteous than I have. She wasn't doing the slimy evil thing. I was. I didn't give her to Shelah, my son. So he recognizes that he didn't fulfill the obligation properly. Although now she's pregnant, she's going to have not only one son, but two. So she doesn't need that. And he says he never knew her again. So she's technically his wife, I guess, a concubine, but he's not going to have regular relations with her. But she's part of the family, and the sons are going to be raised, and they'll be part of the clan of Judah. Basically, now you've got three to carry on the name. Shelah is still alive. Apparently, he'll get married and have kids because they show up in the genealogies. But so will Zerah and Perez, whom we'll meet in a moment. But again, this might be a turning point for Judah. I wanted to mention, so far we see Judah not being a very good guy, right? He left the family. He marries someone maybe he shouldn't have. His sons are so wicked, God kills them. You know, he's going to visit a prostitute, he thinks. So he's not doing so good. There must be a transformation, and maybe this is the turning point when it's put in his face. I did this. She's more right. You know, he's looking, he's saying she should be burned to death, and now he's got to say she's more righteous than I am. In a sense, that's saying I should be the one being burned. And I'm just dropping that as a possibility. At some point, Judah turns, and we're going to see later he's becomes a stand-up guy, a guy that the brothers trust, that his father trusts, and he becomes a leader among the clan. So he's not there now, but he's going to be later on. Anyways, from there we go on to the brief story at the end of Tamar giving birth to these twins. Yeah, I've got a note. This lengthy story might not have been in the Bible at all, except for it's an important part of the lineage of Jesus Christ, as we'll see. If you want to make the connection, it's listed in the lineage in Matthew chapter 1, verse 3. So that's Matthew 1, 3, and Luke 3, 33. Luke 3 and verse 33. And it wouldn't be hard to find, even if I didn't give you the scriptures. You just turn around looking for a little bit. But she could have just had one child and it been part of the lineage of Christ. So it gets a little interesting because it says there are twins in her womb. So it was when she was giving birth, one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." We've already seen that the birthright, meaning the firstborn, the right of the birthright is very important in this culture. You know, Esau was very upset, although he valued it little enough to sell it for a bowl of soup, but they cared which one was born first, even if they're twins. But something weird happens. The arm comes back in and the other brother comes out. I don't even want to contemplate what that felt like for the mother giving birth. I mean, to me, it's bizarre that it's even possible, but maybe that this was a miracle also. But they still, so the midwife sees and says, "How did you get through?" I mean, she was amazed too. "This breach be upon you." So his name was called Perez, which means breach, or as it says, breakthrough in my margin. And afterwards, his brother who had the scarlet thread, and his name was called Zerah. Okay, legend and tradition, not necessarily scripture or historical sources, but legend and description and tradition say that these two lineages will be important to the later promises to King David. God is going to promise King David, and you've already covered it, that he would have a dynasty going on in perpetuity. I've got 2 Samuel 7, verse 16. Although I've got a typo. Instead of 2 Sam, it says 2 Seam, S-E-A-M. But anyways, you've covered that. God says, "I'll build you a house, and you'll always have a man to rule over the children of Israel." Okay. David and later Jesus Christ were descended from Perez, or Perez as it says here. And eventually, okay, the descendants going down from there leading to King Zedekiah, who would be the last king of Judah. And we'll cover this in the book of Jeremiah. Zedekiah would have all of his sons killed in front of him and then his eyes put out. So he's not going to have any of his sons continue the line. Oh, how do we fulfill this promise? Well, we know from the story of Jeremiah and tradition that Zedekiah's daughters survived. And tradition says that the prophet Jeremiah took them away from Israel down to Egypt. He went with them and then he escorted them. They landed at Spain and ended up in Ireland, where one of them, tradition says named Tiatefi, married into the royal family ruling in Ireland. And another part of the tradition says generations before that, Israelites had moved into there. And the harriman that Tiatefi married was a descendant of Zerah. And again, I can't show you any history or even scripture that says that, but this is the story. And that when the daughter from the Perez line married the son from the Perez line is when the breach was healed and did fulfill the promise to David. Okay, we'll cover this from the prophecy part. Did I lose you there? Because we know, like I said, David, Jesus Christ are all descended from one branch, one of these two sons. But it's a descendant from the other sons that we believe was in Ireland available to marry a daughter from the same line as the kings. And so the two branches are brought together, and then the son of that daughter would be king and would continue ruling in the British Isles. There is a prophecy in Ezekiel 21, verse 27. And again, I'm going over quickly here because when we go through Jeremiah and Ezekiel, we'll go through this. But Ezekiel 21, 27 says that the crown would be overturned three times. It says overturn, overturn, overturn. And that's been interpreted by some to say the crown was overturned once from Israel to Ireland, second from Ireland to Scotland, then third from Scotland to England, where it now exists in the House of Windsor, which, you know, of course, Queen Elizabeth II, we believe, or many believe, and I think it's probably true, is a descendant of that royal family. And then so is Prince William and his little son George and on from there. We do know that it's the longest continuing ruling royal house in all of Europe. And that the switch from Scotland to England is very well documented. You know, James VI of Scotland became James I of England, gave us the King James Bible, and so on. The switch from Ireland to Scotland is a bit hazy, but most people agree that it did happen. The one from Israel to Ireland is the one that's purely legend. But I shouldn't say purely legend. It's just not documented in written sources that we can point to. But many people think that's the reason chapter 38 is in Genesis. Weren't for that, Genesis would have 49 chapters and we'd be done, and I wouldn't have spent all this time talking about it. Tell you what, let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll pick up with chapter 39 in about 10 minutes.